From the Honorary Secretary saying that it was quite intolerable that speakers and people making displays to the society should not be welcomed by the President and looked after and nurtured by the President from the time that the doors were open. So in a further break with tradition, we've just taken the Speaker out to a good lunch in the hope that it is just possible that he won't remember what he was going to say this afternoon. Now, the reason for this is that in a further break with tradition, he declined the invitation to dinner tonight on the grounds that if you're going all the way back to Winchester, it's not the same as going back to Tokyo or Leipzig or anywhere else. It's a short journey and you have to get away. And in a further break with tradition, he decided that it would help on a complicated subject like this if earlier in the afternoon he gave people a little rundown on what they were looking at so that when he comes to talk about engraving later in the afternoon, you get double your money and twice as much. And so I have pleasure in giving Jeff a brief introduction in the hope that Cobra hasn't affected both of us too much. And he's going to do the 3 o'clock spiel, but the main paper is still at 5 o'clock. So this is not an invitation to all run out now. Anyway, it's very nice to see you. Jeff, it's over to you.
Thank you very much. Now, the purpose of speaking now is twofold. I've never understood why we ask speakers to speak at 5 o'clock about what they're displaying when you're not going to look at the displays again. You only have one objective, and that is to get downstairs and get some of the free booze. So here, and the other reason is that I am rather prolix in my write-ups because I try to make a complete record of the ideas I had when I put the display together, and I thought it might aid you to get round the display within the time between now and 5 o'clock if I give you a rough introduction. So I'm going to talk to you about methods of stamp production, and here I show examples of each of the stamps done by some of the major methods that have been used. And if I can get my new gizmo to work correctly, I'll get there and do it properly. So here, give it a tap or something. No, it's all right, John. I'm all right. So, it just got tired of waiting. So here we have the obvious penny black, and that's engraved from an engraved plate. And the printing process is more truly described as intaglio. And if you can't get on with the Italian, just call it intaglio. We'll all be happy. Please don't call it anything else. This is a more modern example and rather a superb example. Fine example of gravure. And you notice I've dropped the photo because there are various methods other than photographic for producing the gravure plate. And here we have a fine example of a stamp that is printed by letterpress, erroneously described as being surface printed or typo. Sorry, it gives me trouble saying that word. An embossed stamp, which is a form of letterpress printing, and some rather fine early lithography here. This is the Prince Regent Luitpold. If you're not sure who he is, he became Prince Regent when Ludwig II drowned in Starnbergsee. And he was of the family of Wittelsbach. And the last Wittelsbach, Albrecht, died in 1997. And you may not know this, but he was pretender to the British throne. Now, you never knew that a former Bavarian, a descendant from the Bavarian kings, was a pretender to our own throne. But there it was. I think none of them are now claiming to pretend to the throne. So there we are. That's the bit of rubbish. Now, the presentation is in four components, and you must go round them all. You know that I I've been honoured by being made curator of the museum, and I've put together a series of displays in the display cases that reflect methods of stamp production. And I suggest that you do look at these both in the entrance hall and in the basement. Then you're getting what you're getting now. And then there's this display here in the meeting room. And I was asked if I would talk specifically about engraving and stamp production. The person who asked me to do that was David Beach. Of course, he's away on holiday. This is not deliberate. He is not keeping well, and a good friend of his said, come and have a recuperative holiday with me. So we forgive him for that. The museum display is covering these main topics. You'll notice as you sign in, there's a wall cabinet and underneath it, and that's largely dealing with intaglio engraving and letterpress printing, in particular showing you the dies that were produced by Charles Whiting for the Treasury competition in 1839. And there's a modern example of the mill and die process that was developed by Jacob Perkins. And there's some wood engraving, and the lady who did it is in pink towards the back of the room, because wood engraving is a good example of a different aspect of engraving, where instead of being printed intaglio, it's printed by letterpress. And these things get singularly confused in the minds of some, not of course yourselves, but some philatelists. Bottom of the stairs, more Perkins Bacon material, but from the 1879 tender for British stamps, and that was when Perkins Bacon lost the contract and it went to De La Rue. These are all mill and die examples for letterpress printing. Now, this was the thing that gave immense pain to Perkins Bacon. They had always been intaglio printers, and to try and make something for letterpress printing, which was what was specified in the tender, proved to be more than they could reasonably do trying to extend the techniques they had developed. In the basement, look at the Whiting, Charles Whiting, Prince Edward Island plates. And if any of you have read anything by a gentleman in Canada about how these stamps were produced, you might wish to question what he wrote. There are more dies and transfer rollers, examples of Indian native states. I don't know whether that's politically correct to use that word now, but Indian princely states, that's a better word, Indian princely state stamps that were printed by Perkins Bacon, and the Indian lithographic stones that were presented to the society in about, I can't remember now, is it 1915, 1916, something like that. Good. Now, there's the philatelic exhibit, which is here. The suitable kind of expressions are... And please always use a rising intonation on any expletive you may issue, or utter, rather. Definitely we don't want falling tones at the end. But I'm trying to deal with the major printing methods and to give you wherever possible, and it's just about possible to do it for every printing method, to show you the same stamp image printed by two different methods. And not all the time do I give you diagnostics. In fact, after I put that up, I realised I'd only given you a sound diagnostic for letterpress printed stamps, which are erroneously often described as being typo or surface printed, and we won't use those words again. I deal with some aspects of security related to the printing process. Now, the whole of this, of course, is security printing, but we're looking at special security techniques that were used. And, of course, the one which has me sometimes gasping is the fugitive ink. Now, it becomes clear when you read the archives of De La Rue that they had got the Board of Inland Revenue, to be polite, we'll say by the throat, over this idea of the fact that people were going to be washing the cancels off the stamps, and we don't want them to be doing that, so the best idea is to have this special fugitive ink that will wash away, choose how you try to remove the cancellation. Of course, they found they could only make fugitive ink in a medium that were suitable for letterpress printing. They couldn't do it for intaglio printing. This was rather fine for them because it kind of pushed Perkins Bacon into the background, especially if this fugitive ink idea was very important. And they used it for a very long time to hang on to the contract. My interpretation of the archive is that they really had got them by the throat. Gum, desperately sticky problem. I apologize for some of the examples are difficult for you to see. You really need to have them in your hand and get them at glancing incidents of light in order to see them truly. Then along the back, there's a very, very quick discussion of separation, which includes perforating. Rouletting is something that's used so rarely, we should never really use the word. Piercing is the better word, and our French brethren, I use that loosely, never refer to rouletting, and we concocted all these different words for forms of rouletting, which is percer, this, that, and the other. Die stamping is the right kind of word to use. Basic requirements. These should be pretty obvious. It's got to be hard to forge, or it's pointless doing it by. But when you look at some of these Indian stamps here, you could forge them with your jumbo printing outfit. You have to have a means of easily replicating in an identical way the same image so that you produce the printing form. Yes, there is an E at the end of it. It refers only to the surface from which you make a print. It's unique, that spelling, to printing. The cost per stamp has got to be very, very low. And you find that in the end, Delarue were quoting something like 4 3/8 of a pence per 1,000 stamps printed when they did the Jubilee issue. So it's significantly cheap way of doing things. The printing form must be capable of printing millions of stamps before it wears out, and that is quite a hard objective to meet. So these are the methods that I primarily deal with, intaglio or intaglio or recess, and letterpress or relief. Now, the problem with recess and relief is that the words have similar phonetic components and there's scope for confusion. It depends whether you're standing at the bottom of the valley or at the top of the hill, whether it's relief or recess, for instance. Surface printed, it really shouldn't be used. Unfortunately, throughout the whole of the Delarue correspondence at that time and in their archive, they always refer to it as surface printing, alas. But don't use typography. Typography is what I and Frank Walton, when he's doing LP, engage in when we're laying out this text prettily. It is the art of design in text and the design of books and other printed artifacts. It's nothing to do with the printing process. Lithography. Well, we use that word because it tends to have been adopted by the printing profession and by the artists, likewise with intaglio. But stone printing would have been better, and in German, of course, it's Steindruck. So, but let's stick with the lithography now. And I do have a few bits about thumb methods and some new technology. And new technology happens all the time, sometimes in a very, very serious and positive way for how stamps are being produced today. And if any of you are caught in the catchpenny that Royal Mail run called the Prestige Booklets, they have introduced two very interesting new and rather fine methods of printing the first-class stamp, which I recommend to you. Well, by the same process, they've now been done lithographically there, but by two different printing houses. And the fun methods, well, they're fun methods, and you should look at them. But there's new technology and new vital processes happening today that we largely ignore and which are going to be of crucial importance if, in another 50 years, there are any philatelists. I mean, I have that horror of our youngest member, Simon Moorcroft, in 50 years' time, saying to someone, come round to my philatelic society, and it might be my philatelic society, might be the only person left in it. So we have to be very careful. Now, just to drive this message home a bit more, if it's engraved and printed intaglio, you make an incisions into the metal or into the printing form, and they usually will be V-shaped, and that, remember that, that's important later on. If it's let, so you put in the ink in the incision and wipe in the rest of the surface of the plate clean, and the paper is pressed into where you've engraved it and the ink is pulled out. Letterpress, the ink is on the surface of a raised object and the ink is taken up by the paper. Lithography relies upon some rather subtle physics that Zehnerfelder, when he developed this, didn't necessarily think about the physics, but it's the physics of ink and grease and water. The ink will stick to the greasy object that you wish to print. It is repelled by the wet stone. And it's worth thinking about ink. You have to make this ink very carefully, because you want in some gunge that will stick to metal or to grease on a stone, and will prefer to be there than on the inking roller or the ink or whatever the ink is applied with. And then when you press it onto the paper, this ink prefers to be on the paper rather than to remain behind on the stone. And if you just think, if you try to ink these up with the ink that you, well, the three or four of us, put in our fountain pens, then it wouldn't work. So you have to have the ink in a medium that's got the right physical properties to stick onto the surface of the printing form and then to release itself onto the paper. Now, this is something that you may think is abundantly obvious, but it is so often misused and misconstrued that people get confused between engraving referring to the printing process. It isn't. It's the method by which you make the printing form. You can print that printing form either letterpress or intaglio afterwards. So engraving and intaglio are not synonyms. Now, why we find engraving prefixed by line, I have no idea. It's just superfluous junk that's put in front of the word engraving. Don't use it, please, anymore. Is Hugh here? He's not come yet. You see, I'm beating Hugh up over the terminology used in his catalogues. I'll wait for my little quip to Hugh for when Hugh arrives later on. He said it was a three-line whip and he was definitely coming. Right. Copper and steel engraving. Copper engraving was the first thing that was used. And these were means of image and picture reproduction used by artists. And then steel engraving, which has a very posh word that you shouldn't use. It's called siderography. And it was really very much brought to the fore by Jacobs Perkins for security uses, and other artists followed suit. But the picture is incised into the surface, and the incised lines form the image. So the ink is put into the incisions, and it's usually printed intaglio. Wood engraving, and there's a fine example downstairs. The wood is cut away, and the image is left, is the wood that's left behind, and you put the ink on the surface of the wood, and invariably print it letterpress. Now, here, Perkins Bacon tried to produce letterpress printing plates using the techniques that they developed, that were developed by Jacob Perkins for intaglio printing of postage stamps and other security documents. And they had immense trouble, but it's the same process. You remove the metal that you don't want to print, and what you leave behind is the metal that takes the ink and is printed. So we got to stamps at last. God, he thought, how we ever get in there? But thanks to Douglas Muir, we have a fine photograph of the old original die that, if I'm wearing white gloves, he lets me hold. And I have taken an enlargement of the centre portion and just transposed it so you could see what it was like. And because I'm not a man of... great wealth, I don't have an amount of mint examples of the first three stamps that were produced there. But these are superb examples of largely mechanical engraving, and that was one of the things that Jacob Perkins developed. It wasn't how by hand you could cut an image into steel, but it was how you could mechanically reproduce patterns on the steel that would be hard to forge. And this background here, I'm not used to this thing, you know. This background here is very interesting, and you will hear more about it as we go along. Now, this is the press. This is the Perkins Bacon press. It's not the press that was used for the first stamps because it isn't wide enough. But I'm looking around. Yeah, you're just about all old enough to remember a mangle for winding your washing through to squash the water out. Well, it's like a mangle with two steel rollers, and you wind this steel plate through it. You put the printing plate on here, ink it all up, wipe it clean and everything, put a piece of paper on top. Now, if you're an artist, at this point you put a felt blanket on top, but this has got a bit of mechanization in it. So you start winding this handle here, the plate goes through there, this is the blanket comes down onto the paper, and then the whole job lot is rolled between the two steel rollers, and the paper takes up the ink. The cunning thing about this is that on the top roller, there's a flat, so that when you've wound all the way around and the flat becomes parallel with the plate, these weights here on the blanket and this weight down at the bottom pull the whole bed out again, and you can take it off. So it can be operated by one man from one side. See, artists today, they ink it up, wind it through, and then walk round to the other side of the roller and take the paper off. But this is a one-sided operation, and we will encounter this flat cylinder approach in letterpress printing as well later on. Now, how do you make the die? Now, these are examples that we have downstairs. They are examples of making a letterpress die along the top, but you effectively engrave a die here, pick it up on this thing called a transfer roller, and there's a bit of fancy metallurgy or metallurgy that goes on in between here, hardening the die, making sure the roller's soft, picking it up and hardening the roller. But eventually, it's rolled out onto a printing form, and in these days of Perkins Bacon, it was a flat plate. So you have got an image here, inverted, of course, on the transfer roller, and then you roll that out as many times as you want onto the plate. Here you see the, I think it's the 10 Bob Castles, Edinburgh Castle, being picked up from the die onto a transfer roller. This is a different press, and I think it's a Danish press, because Hugh gave me it from an article on the wavy lines. But here the roller's rolling onto a cylinder. These little things around here are the indexing mechanism to keep stepping the cylinder around to get all the images correctly placed. So you have a means of engraving a die, picking it up on the transfer roller, and then rolling it out as many times. So you've got a means of producing identical copies of the image. And these are examples of printing the 10 Bob up there. This is a combination. This part in the middle here is gravure. The rest are all intaglio. You wonder why I've got a lot of Indian states? Well, some of you will know that I've collected India for a long time. And this, to be quite honest, it's just rubbish that was in my stock book, and I picked the examples out to find a way of using them. Now we come to letterpress printing. Here, if you remember, the ink is applied to the surface and is taken up onto the paper. De La Rue used this Wharfdale stop cylinder press in their printing. This is an example of how you produce half tone, and we'll deal with that in more detail later on. But the main thing is that it's a bit sticking up. You bung the ink on top and roll it through the press. So you see again, it's got a flat on it, on the impression cylinder. This is the inking table here, and the ink is rolled out by these rollers. So now, it's all right. This is wonderful technology. It's made by Microsoft. It will only operate a PowerPoint display and nothing else. But I've got the thick finger problem, which you know from the stock market. So what happens is the ink is rolled out on here. In the impression stroke, the bed of the press goes right across and the type is re-inked and then comes back. And it's coming back when we've got the flat there and the cylinder stops. It gets all the way back here and then the cycle starts again. The paper is fed and goes round and is printed. And there are many advantages to it. These things can run very fast because they're made for printing ordinary letterpress. So it's just the same kind of press that would be used for printing a newspaper or for printing any other printed artifact. I'll just point out a couple of things here. You can get large areas of solid colour. You can't have large areas of solid colour in intaglio printing because, remember, the ink is going into the recesses. If you were trying to wipe a large area, the plate clean with a large area of colour, you'd just wipe the colour out of the large recess. So you'd get shades by engraving greater or lesser density of lines on the plate. So we say better simulation of tone, and we're just looking at that there. Higher speed, cheaper. Still use engraving for producing the dies, but the whole process is less crisp, less sharp than if you were doing intaglio printing, but it's cheaper. A few examples. The thing to note here is there's some diagnostic points worth noting here. Whether these work as diagnostics or not depends upon the quality of the press work. If the plate is inked up with a ton of ink on it and the pressure's too high on the impression roller, then you will get these phenomena. If it's very carefully inked and the pressure's right, you don't see them. So we'll look here for these stamps produced in India by the local printing press of, is it Nawanagara? No, I can't remember which one it is. But you notice this black line around the edge of everything. That's because the ink's squashed out to the side of the image. Now, if there's not too much ink on and the pressure's just right, you don't get that happening. And you'll notice here that it's very, there might be a bit of a line there, but generally speaking, it's nice and clean. In this one here, you do see the darker line around the edge. So if in doubt, that's a good thing to look for. It doesn't always work, though, unfortunately. Now, how do we produce a letterpress printing form? Well, first of all, a die is engraved here. Then it's put into this collar. That's the die at the bottom, the lid's put on, turned over. A carefully machined slug of lead is dropped in, and this plunger put on top. And a man in a brown smock pulls the lever and you get an impression. So you're producing like a piece of type, just like the type that is used for typesetting text. And it's the same size as well, but you keep producing type which has got identical images on it, and you assemble them all in a frame which is called a chase. And then you don't print from that because it won't last very long. So you make an electrotype from it by essentially coating the whole thing with graphite, which acts as a conducting agent and a releasing agent, and deposit copper onto that, or later on nickel was deposited. These are not leads. And it was a while before I realized why we never see any leads anywhere and why we never see any wax molds. And that is the lead could be recycled, or the type metal could be recycled to cast more leads from it. And likewise, the wax could be recycled to make more wax molds. But roughly speaking, the leads look a bit like this. The thing is about these is the image is also transposed. Or it's a mirror image, so it's wrong as well. But they look a bit like that, and the type height. Anybody interested, that's the diameter of a shilling, so don't throw the shillings away that you've got. And here is just saying in words what I've already spoken about. Here you see the process graphically. The die, the lead is, the die and the lead are brought together and we get a lead image. Doing it again. Then it is copper plated, the lead is removed, and we've got a copper shell. Now, the thing is, the part that's been in contact with the die is a true facsimile of the die surface. We're not talking about depositing copper like doing chromium plating of your bumpers of your car, where you see the deposited surface on top of the base metal underneath. We are depositing copper, but it's the part that's in contact with the lead when it's taken away that is the true image of what was on the lead and what is used for the printing. So we're here, then you back it up with tight metal under about this thick, about, you know, 3 millimetres, quarter of an inch thick. The advantage of that is that it's very much lighter. It's also easier to handle. If you've got a chase full of 240 subjects bolted together, the guy only has to stumble getting towards the press, and it's all over the floor, and it's all damaged, and it's a mess. So it's easier to store. And until the advent of lithography, electrodes were always made for books that were thought to have a long run or where there would be more than one impression taken. And I have a plate of the Oxford Dictionary. This microphone is working, is it? So when I'm not looking at you, you can hear me. Good. You can see this downstairs. It's the electro from some of the Prince Edward Island stamps. There's massive discussion about how these stamps were printed. I will not engage in any discussion for fear that I don't say quite polite things about some of the things that have been written. Now, how do you produce a die? Now, the method that was used by Delarue was slightly different to that used by Perkins Bacon, but essentially, you make a head and engrave the head, and there are actually, is it five heads here? One, two, four heads and five frames. You produce a head die, harden your die, pick it up on a transfer roller and roll it out onto a soft die. And then you start engraving the frame around it. Thick finger problems getting a bit bad here, isn't it? I apologize. And then when you've done that, you've got the basic outline of a frame with the head in it, and you can put the values in, and you can use that twice, as that happened here. So you get the same head used several times with different frames on the different frame used in different circumstances. So you have a way of producing many different stamps with the minimum amount of effort. Now we get to lithography. This was invented just at the end of the 1700s by Alois Zehnerfelder in Austria. And the essence of it is that you're relying upon a very smooth stone. It's a form of limestone on which you have a greasy image. And greasy, you have to accept that with a very white context, drawn on the stone. The stone is dampened. The stone becomes wet where the image isn't, and where the greasy image is, it does not take up the water. So then you have an ink that you roll on it that is taken up by the greasy image but doesn't get taken up onto the damp stone. Then you put a paper on it and you can print from that and pick up an image. There are a lot of advantages to lithography, and this was developed, of course, for artists, is that the artist can draw on the stone, so he's drawing a much more fluid image than if he's relying upon some engraver to take his oil painting or whatever it is and copy it to the stone. So you're actually having the artist's work done there on the stone, and that was the big advantage of it. And it rapidly became used for printing other objects. But you see there are three real approaches. You can draw directly on the stone, or what is often done, you can transfer a print. So the stones we have downstairs, the Indian stones, you'll see there are some intaglio plates there that prints were taken from them on thin transfer tissue with a suitable ink that wouldn't dry too quickly, and then transferred onto the lithographic stone. And then the printing took place on the lithographic stone. And you can easily clean the stone up when the image gets a bit mushy and lay down a new image. And, of course, photography was used. Photography was used a lot for, in later years, for laying down the image. And, of course, nowadays it's all done with laser printing directly onto the plate. It has tended to be used only for short runs for modern stamps. So until last year, stamps of Northern Ireland were always printed lithographically because they never had ever more than one printed, which is quite surprising, but that seems to have been the case. So here's how it works. You can make an image, and this is a half, grossly exaggerated half-tone plate. Finger problem again. You wet it first, then you ink it. Then it goes into this rather fine... I mean, it's a wonderful machine that they had originally, but you have your stone here, the paper on top of it, and the tympan is usually a thin brass sheet. And then this scraper that you have a handle, and there are various forms, and Jim at the back of the room... Have you got rid of your press? Jim had a lithographic press like this that you can press down, and then you wind it through, and the pressure is applied with a kind of an overlarge squeegeeing process, and you get the image at the other end. Of course, nowadays, we have these fancy offset litho processes where you've got the damping system here, damping a zinc plate, the massive inking mechanism here that then inks it. Then the image is I've got too fat a thumb. The image is then transferred to the blanket cylinder and then onto the paper with the impression cylinder, applying the pressure there. And it's all rather fine. These are some of the earlier lithographic stamps produced from stones similar to those downstairs. You can hand draw them. Look at this very carefully. If you look at the Roman letters, you find that every stamp is different. If you look at the Arabic or Urdu, you find that they're very nearly the same. And the person obviously had no skill or ability in drawing our alphabet, and so he had difficulty with it. But this was drawn directly onto the stone, and this is a print taken from it, and it's somewhere just around here. Can't see it offhand. Right. This is probably the first example of photomultiplication, and this is Luitpold, again, the Prince Regent. He was one of the first people to have a Mohican haircut, and you should look at the pictures here to see how fine that ridge is down the centre of his head. I'm pretty sure that the original image here was an etching, because the lines are quite fluid and are obviously just drawn by hand. They're not engraved in a very determined kind of way. And from that, some transfer was made onto the lithographic stone. We now get to gravure. It's an intaglio process inasmuch as the ink is in recesses in the surface. But it's a means of generating tone, and generating very good tone. And the tone is generated by having cells of different depths so that they take up different amounts of ink. And so you get an image that has got a gradation in tone, in density of the colour. And it is actually spinning in a bucket of ink like that, the cylinder, and is scraped clean with the doctor blade. I expect this is the mechanization of mezzotinting. It's got a lot of similarities to the mezzotint process, except that the image is laid down photographically on top of the screen that you see over here. Now, this came from a book that the Times produced for their centenary, I think it was. It's a super book on printing, and there's some rather fine examples of printed stamps in there done by Bradbury, I think it's Bradbury Wilkinson or Waterlow. You see, it must be a mucky process. I mean, look at this guy here. It looks like he's swimming in the ink. This is the bucket of ink here, the trough of ink. Clean end with the clean paper, and the boy obviously isn't getting quite as dirty. And this is a cylinder for printing the pictorial educator. You'd be amazed what is printed by gravure these days. Quite often, soap powder packets are printed by gravure because they can get massive runs compared with letterpress. These rather flashy magazines of the vulgar, more grandiose type are printed by gravure as well. But a lot are now, I think, started to be done by lithography. The essence is that you have to provide a surface that has got pits in it to take up the ink, but you have to be able to modify whether the pits take up the ink or not by overlaying an image photographically. Now, you can make the pit process by one of two methods. You can either do something that is a strong relative of aquatinting, where you spread across the whole plate fine granules of either bitumen or resin, and then heat the plate so that these particles stick to it, so you've got this grainy structure. Or you can expose photographically a ruled pattern on it. So you see both processes here used on Egyptian stamps. They used to, well, they still do print some rather nice stamps, Egypt. Oh, that went rather quickly, didn't it? Now, just a quick thing on full colour, and we're about there. First of all, we'd look at how you represent tone. Now, this is a continuous tone wedge going from totally black to totally white, and this is how it might be realised in half tone by varying sizes of dots. And you're relying entirely upon your eye smearing these dots together to give you the impression of a continuous grey tone. It's done somewhat the same way in four-colour printing. The reason that these what appear to be strange angles is that it stops you getting a moiré pattern. A moiré pattern is when you're going down the motorway and you see the railings on the bridge and the dark bands moving across. It's to stop you getting that same kind of interference pattern here. This, I was delighted when I found this. I was in Gibbons and I said, look, I'm looking for examples of what are erroneously called self-adhesive stamps, because just about all stamps that are issued are self-adhesive. You either lick them to activate the gum or you peel the backing off. And the guy was a bit, you know, well, God, the funny thing. And then he got into the spirit of what I was doing. He said, have you seen these? And he brought this sheet out. Now, I had no interest in it as being an example of how you separate and sell one self-adhesive stamp, but it was the fact that it had this down the centre. So this is printed in yellow. This is the cyan. Oh, I'm sorry about this. This is the cyan component. That cyan is the strange blue. This is the two printed together. Then we have the magenta component, and the three then printed together. Now, you probably can't see it from where you are, but the blacks are a bit muddy. So here the rest have had the fourth colour black printed on, and that's because the complementary colours were mixed together don't give you a very good black, so you have to enhance it. And I was rather chuffed with getting that, and here at the bottom it tells you the sequence in which the colours were printed. And it's done by Walsall, and there are a few issues that did for Tonga, such as this. So the rest of the display round the corner is going to deal with, we're going to call it underprinting, aren't we? God only knows what bourrelage means. I can't even find it in a dictionary. I mean, you could call it wugga ugga, because it would just have the same meaning to most people, I would think. Now, we do accept that we have a word, B-L-U-E, that means blue, and we know that we associate that sound with that colour there. But the only thing we can do is associate bourrelage with what you see around here. So call it underprinting. The German catalogues always use Unterdruck, of course. Another example of it is Winchester security paper. Now, I live in Winchester. I can't find who made this security paper. You see some examples from Venezuela. Well, beyond belief, because you can't see the stamp image printed on top of them for some things. This overprinting with iridium ink, you probably have never realised that it's happening. The purply coloured £1 stamps and the higher values all have an iridium overprint with the Queen's Head vignetted out. And when you hold the stamps at an angle, you see that they have this glisteningness about them. Iridium ink is made from finely divided mica. And then we get to Delarue's Beacon, the fugitive ink. It comes out in the wash. I'll tell you about this. I have bought clean, nice, new stamps reputedly printed in fugitive ink. And I cannot get the ink to wash away. I've got some old examples around here. You see it's washed away. It has been suggested to me that I was too cheap. If I didn't use stamps that were only costing me a few pence, but were to buy a stamp that cost me £100, I'd be sure that the ink would be fugitive when I tried. I have resisted that temptation. Gum breakers. These are wonderful things. You should look at the gum breakers carefully. And then just on the back, the four frames at the back, deal with a very brief exposition on the question of separation. And I don't deal really with anything to do with how stamps that are so-called self-adhesives are got off the backing or supposedly perforated or anything like that. So that's what you have the joy, I use that term loosely, the joy of looking at here. Or that you're now seeing underneath the clothing of the lady, aren't you? But there we are. Please enjoy what I've really enjoyed doing. And if you want to ask any questions, if you're a bit worried about the errors of my ways, then feel free to ask me. There will be a masterclass. I use that term. A masterclass at 5 o'clock. On just engraving and its use in stamp production. I'm going to look at engraving from intaglio printing perspective and from the letterpress printing perspective. Thank you very much. And thank you for so many comments.